Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. This is January 22nd, 2014. And what I'm doing here is pretty much continuing the series of talks I've been doing on the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths. And the last several evenings, we have focused on suffering and its causes, and also the causes of the end of suffering in relationships. For example, last week I talked about letting go of delusional fear of others or needless anxiety around other people. Before that, I have talked about other aspects of, you know, not feeling so troubled or disturbed in our relationships with other people. And because I won't be with you for 4 weeks, I thought I'd leave you on a strong note and not hold anything back. So I want to read one of the more well-known suttas or teachings of the Buddha that doesn't hold anything back either, that's very related to this topic. And given the time frames here, I think that's appropriate, so I'll just kind of zip right into it, all right? So if I could, the context is that these teachings were handed down, as you probably know, over many, many centuries before they were written down. So, you know, things get mixed in, and sometimes the teachings are kind of jumbled and so forth, so we have to work our way through that. Also, what comes down to us is traditional language and also the worldview and examples drawn from a culture, a feudal culture that was rural and agrarian and very, very different from our own. This is the time here of the ancient Greeks, if you will. You know, Aristotle, Alexander the Great, and the Buddha were rough, you know, contemporaries in terms of time. This is 2,500 years ago. So in that context, I want to read you here the Buddha's teaching about how we should be with others, especially with others who provoke us. It's easy to be with others who are doing exactly what we want them to do. They're perfectly attuned, they're responsive, they load the dishwasher correctly, they initiate conversation routinely, they initiate sex routinely, right? They parent the children the way we want them to and all the rest of that, right? Trouble happens, of course. Their politics are perfect, you know, they like the same blogs that we do. Okay, but what about when people are not that way? When they, in fact, mistreat us even quite badly. What do we do then? So this is the Buddha's teaching, and it's a fairly high bar. See what you think about it. So here we go. This is the simile of the saw from the Majjhima Nikaya. And I'll read through this. I'll slow down a bit from time to time, hear what you think about it, and I might make a little comment along the way to explain something. Okay. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's grove. Jetta was a benefactor who generously gave that grove, you know, for people to live in. Jetta's grove, Anatta Pindika's park. Now, on that occasion, the venerable Moliya Phaguna was associating overmuch with bhikkhunis, female nuns. There are some fairly humorous passages in here. He was associating so much with bhikkhunis that if any bhikkhu or monk spoke dispraise of those bhikkhunis in his presence, he would become angry and displeased and would make a case of it. And if any bhikkhu, male monk, spoke dispraise of the venerable Moliya Phaguna in those bhikkhunis' presence, they would become angry and displeased and would make a case of it. So much was the venerable Moliya Phaguna associating with bhikkhunis. Then a certain bhikkhu went to the Blessed One, the Buddha, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and told the Blessed One what was taking place. Then the Blessed One addressed a certain bhikkhu, a certain male monk, thus, "Come, bhikkhu, tell the bhikkhu Moliya Phaguna in my name that the teacher calls him." "Yes, venerable sir," he replied, and he went to the venerable Moliya Phaguna and told him, "The teacher calls you, friend Phaguna." "Yes, friend," Phaguna replied, and he went to the Blessed One and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One asked him, "Phaguna, is it true that you are associating overmuch with bhikkhunis? That you are associating so much with bhikkhunis that if any bhikkhu, male monk, speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you become angry and displeased and make a case of it? And if any bhikkhu speaks dispraise of you in those bhikkhunis' presence, they become angry and displeased and make a case of it. Is this true? Are you associating so much with bhikkhunis as it seems? Yes, venerable sir. Phaguna, the Buddha responded, are you not a clansman who has gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness? In other words, become a monk. Yes, venerable sir. Phaguna, it is not proper for you, a clansman gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, to associate overmuch with bhikkhunis. Therefore, if anyone speaks dispraise of those bhikkhunis in your presence, you should abandon any desires and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein, you should train thus. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for his welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. That is how you should train. Phaguna. If anyone should give you a blow with his hand, with a clod, with a stick, or with a knife, you should abandon any desires and any thoughts based on the household life. And herein you should train thus. My mind will be unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for the welfare of these other people, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. That is how you should train, Phaguna. The Buddha goes on to say, therefore, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states, for that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Suppose there were a big solid tree grove near a village or town, and it was choked with castor oil weeds, and some man would appear desiring its good, welfare, and protection. He would cut down and throw out the crooked saplings that robbed the sap, and he would clean up the interior of the grove and tend the straight, well-formed saplings, so that the solid tree grove later on would come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. So too, people, abandon what is unwholesome and devote yourself to wholesome states, for that is how you will come to growth, increase, and fulfillment in this teaching and practice. Formerly, people, in this same Savatthi town, there was a housewife named Vedahika. And a good report about Mistress Vedahika had spread thus. Mistress Vedahika is gentle. Mistress Vedahika is meek. Mistress Vedahika is peaceful. Now, Mistress Vedahika had a maid named Kali, who was clever, nimble, and neat in her work. The maid Kali thought, a good report about my lady has spread thus. Mistress Vedahika is gentle. Mistress Vedahika is meek. Mistress Vedahika is peaceful. How is it now, while she does not show anger, is it nevertheless actually present in her? Or is it absent? Or else, is it just because my work is neat that my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her? Suppose I test my lady. So the maid Kali got up late. The mistress Vedahika said, hey, Kali! What is it, madam? What is the matter with you, Kali, that you get up so late? Nothing is the matter, madam. Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up so late. And she was angry and displeased, the mistress Vedahika, and she scowled. Then the maid Kali thought, the fact is that while my lady does not show anger, it is actually present in her, not absent. And it is just because my work is neat that my lady shows no anger, though it is actually present in her, not absent. Suppose I test my lady a little more. So there are a couple more paragraphs of her getting up later and later. And then, so finally, Madam Vedahika says, nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up still later in the day. And she was angry and displeased, and she took a rolling pin gave the maid Kali a blow on the head and cut her head. Then the maid Kali, with blood running from her cut head, denounced her mistress to the neighbors. "See, ladies, the gentle ladies' work. See, ladies, the meek ladies' work. See, ladies, the peaceful ladies' work. How can she become angry and displeased with her only maid for getting up late? How can she take a rolling pin, give her a blow on the head, and cut her head?" Then later on, a bad report about Mistress Vedahika spread thus: "Mistress Vedahika is rough. Mistress Vedahika is violent. Mistress Vedahika is merciless." So too, people, if some people are extremely gentle, extremely meek, extremely peaceful, so long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch them. But it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch people that it can be understood whether a person is really kind, gentle, and peaceful. Therefore, you should train yourself thus. Actually, I'll kind of skip that part. It's not that clear. So then he goes on to say, "Bhikkhus, there are these five courses of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. However they address you, you should train yourself thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind, the person who has wronged you. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with this person, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That is how you should train." And then he finishes up here. He says, "Even if bandits were to sever you," so he goes through a series of escalating examples. This is the final one. "People, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, a person who gives rise to a mind of hate towards these attackers would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, people, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That is how you should train." People, if you keep this advice on the example of the saw that he just gave, if you keep this advice consistently in mind, do you see any course of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? "No, venerable sir," they replied. So then the Buddha goes on to say, "Therefore, you should keep this advice on the simile of the saw constantly in mind. That will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time." That is what the Blessed One said. The people listening were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. I don't know if you read this kind of stuff very often. I find it really quite powerful, especially in a good translation. So I want to draw your attention to a couple of things. It's a pretty strong passage, isn't it? See what you have to say, and then see what you have to say. First point is about intention. What's our intention? Reactions arise. People say things to us, they do things to us. We're animals, social animals. We have histories. We're sensitized to things. Sometimes it's just a bad day. We haven't eaten in a while. You know, there was a traffic accident. We got bad news at work, something, right? We react. The reaction arises. But what's the intention? What's the background intention that is the context for the upset that arises in you? And also when, you know, you have a little bit of mindfulness about what's coming up, the anger, the hurt, the shock, the alarm, the fear, at that point as well, what's the intention? That's the Buddha's admonition. That's his practice. You know, set your intention so that when things happen, you're not so rattled by them. And second, when things happen and you are rattled by them, as soon as you can find the least bit of footing, set your attention again. So that's the first thing. It's about intention. It's not about perfection. It's about the gradual effect of wholesome intentions of mind and heart. So you can ask yourself, fundamentally, in with this person, what's my intention? Is it to prove that I'm right or something else? Right? Is it to pay them back or is it something else? Is it to act out of fear and alarm or is my intention something else? It's a very useful question to ask ourselves. The second kind of headline for me out of all this is this idea of a mind imbued with, full of, you know, kind of juicy with a certain caring for others, a certain loving kindness for other people. And to me, that's a neat idea. It's a little bit like, you know, the mind like a sponge, right? Is it all dried up? Or is it kind of juicy with a prior inclination toward compassion and kindness for others? And when we have thoughts about others, or we make plans about them, or we evaluate situations, what's pervading the mind? You know, is it a mind of ill will or goodwill? Is it a mind of confidence or fear? Is it a mind of kindness or hate? What's infusing the mind? And then the last thing just to say about it is that, you know, the Buddha sets a high bar. And when I think about people that I know about or I've read about who have managed to deal with really awful, horrible conditions while remaining both strong and true to their own practice, true to their own commitment to non-harming and to speaking the truth and to taking responsibility for their own experience. You know, when I think about people who've, for example, spent years and years in prisons, unjustly accused, or who've been terribly mistreated in other ways. And I think to myself, if they can do that, I can handle somebody cutting me off in the freeway and making a rude gesture with a finger of a hand, right? I can handle some kind of, you know, person hassling me in some way. And so I just offer that to you as well. Okay, what did you think about that passage, including maybe some of the ancient cultural framing, the lady and her maid, bandits, the you know, sexist language and all the rest of that? Or, you know, maybe more fundamentally, what did you think of the call to intention and action from the Buddha? Comments or questions, and then we'll finish up. Yeah.
Well, I just want to appreciate the line of speaking that you've had here lately with our being aware of our fear last week. I had a completely new behavior out of that. And that was, I was in a rather heated conversation in which I jumped on the hook of my post-traumatic stress. And my nervous system reacted pretty violently. And so in staying with the practice, I said, I just have to get off the phone, I'll call you back. And instead of engaging, instead of coming up with harsh words in return, fairly new behavior.
That's great. Good for you.
And so the saw is an extreme example. It's like,
I would fail the test. But I'm trying. That's the important thing.
Yeah, it's kind of the Jesus test as well. But yeah. It is an extreme example, and holding that in, like, okay, you're cutting me up with a saw, you must really be suffering.
Yeah, it hurts like hell, and I really wish you wouldn't.
Yeah.
And I think it's a criminal act, and I'm not going to get lost in my hatred. So thank you for saying that. I won't try to recap it for the recording. But what I will share is that as you were talking, I noticed honestly, just a kind of, at this point, an increasingly habitual practice for me. And you might be doing it yourself, too. And so here's the question, you know, when you're talking with someone, when you're interacting with somebody, one, are you seeing what's good in them? Like for me, I try to cultivate the habit of seeing the good in the other person. Often it's sort of running in the background. Sometimes it becomes more prominent. Often when they're being difficult in some way, that's especially when I try to activate that habit to see what's good in them. Doesn't mean I agree with them, but I can see what's good about that person, you know. And then the second thing is, do I wish them well? It's not just, do I see what's good? Do I see the being behind the eyes? Do I see the caring, the kindness, the efforts, and so forth? But also, is there, am I kind of for them, you know? Is there a leaning toward them? I had a spiritual teacher for a while, and in his ashram, one of his ashrams, they planted a tree, and they were trying to get it to stand up straight, and they couldn't do it. It was always leaning one way or another. And after a while, he said, don't worry, grace leans. So I think about the leaning toward others, you know, wishing them well, doing what we can for them if we can, and so forth. So you might want to ask yourself those questions. You know, do I see the good in the other person? And am I for them in some way? Do I wish them well? Great. A lot of hands.
And do I see the good in myself?
Sure. Do I see the good in myself as well?
Important.
Yeah. Very important. No, that's great. And in a funny way, isn't it? I bet you have found. Have you found that as you see the good in yourself, you're also more able to be generous and see the good in others, even sometimes when others are provocative? Yeah. That's great. Thank you. Great. A few more? Yeah. Right there. Yeah, you, definitely.
You mentioned in the earlier part of the talk about the difference between a householder and
A monastic, a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni.
I was thinking of that, also thinking of how it felt hearing, you know, the prescribed, how you react to the situations. And, you know, just the idea of right action or wise action, you know, that just to be passive wouldn't necessarily be wise action.
Yeah.
And to have that kind of discernment to where, you know, you can stand up for yourself and without having a, you know, a hateful attitude toward somebody and set limits and in terms of what you're bringing into the world, that could be the most compassionate thing. Allowing somebody to harm you wouldn't be good for them or you necessarily.
Right.
And how to make that kind of discernment, what is the wise action in the specific case, I think is something, you know, important to look at. So.
That's a beautiful comment, and to kind of recap it a little bit and then take it a certain place, I mean, to me you're talking about the importance of non-harming applied to oneself, much as we wouldn't want to allow someone else to be harmed if we could prevent it. Well, in the same benevolence, the same moral justifications, we wouldn't want to let ourselves be harmed either. So there's a real place for that. And for myself, there's this visual metaphor that's there for me. I'll just share it with you. Imagine two boats, you know, let's say they have motor boats, okay? And one boat and goes in this direction, heads north, except to get north, it uses a lot of stinky, horrible fossil fuel. Right? And smells bad and hurts a lot of people in the process. But it sure is good at going north. That is the way a lot of us have learned how to assert ourselves. We draw on stinky old fuels of anger and ill will and righteousness and indignation to, you know, arm ourselves, to fire ourselves up, so we can deal with that adversary, right? That's our vehicle. That's the vehicle that's enabled us you know, to produce a good end. It's toward a good aim, to stick up for ourselves, to prevent harms for ourselves, maybe to stick up for other people as well. We know how to do it with that kind of anger. That boat will get us north. It takes us north. But at what cost? Right? And there's often a transitional process where people step out of one familiar vehicle that serves a good purpose, but at a high price, you know. And they gradually help themselves get into a parallel boat, a different boat, that can also head north, but in a much more wholesome, effective, harmonious, less harmful, harming kind of way. And that's the process people are often in, and often a lot of us are sort of in the middle. We're in between. We're stepping out of an old vehicle that worked for us in our childhood maybe, or in really tough conditions. It's kind of what we needed to do. But we're working our way out of it to get into a different vehicle that can still accomplish the same purpose. And there's this real interesting process of recognizing the collateral damage of the old vehicle, and then also recognizing as we grow into a new way of being, to really help it sink in and develop confidence that this approach works too. It's a different way. I can assert myself with other people with gravity and dignity and clarity and no apologies without getting righteous and angry about it. Ah, I can develop confidence in that way of being with other people, for example. Yeah. And there's a process, I think, of helping ourselves make this transition from one vehicle to the other one. So again, you could ask yourself, how are you helping yourself these days to make that transition?
When I asked the question, what was in my mind was a way of skillfully kind of, you know, doing kind of an Aikido kind of thing with the energy where you weren't falling into these states, and therefore it helped transform the situation with the person.
Yeah, that's right. To again say what you just said, you know, if we don't get caught up in a mind of ill will, right, often we're actually more effective with other people. Maybe one last person, and then we'll take a wrap. Great.
I don't know how to articulate this, because I think purifying our mind takes time.
Yeah.
Even though I know I want to reach here, but I'm still here. So if I see someone, I don't have that, like, really kind towards the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have ill will, but there could something happened. I could help the person do something. Feel natural for me at that moment. Do I just don't do anything, or do I help the person? Does that make me a hypocrite? You know, like,
right.
It's like a generosity has to be out of your pure heart.
Yes.
I don't want to help, just be kind. It's kind of a spiritual posturing. It's not
right.
Natural for me. What should I do?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'll repeat it if I could and make sure I get it right, okay? So in this context, what do? In situations where our mind is telling us that we could help someone and we even should help someone, but our heart is not really there. Our heart is not really in it. We don't feel it. Okay? Right. And is there a danger in making ourselves help people or be kind to them, or even wish them well in our mind, when it's not authentic to us? Is that a kind of act or phoniness that, and I'll add my own words here, could potentially corrupt what's actually sincere and heartfelt? You know, for example, we probably know people who put on the act of being a do-gooder, right? And that creates problems for others, right? So I don't have a perfect answer. The way I personally experience this is that I think there's a range of what's authentically available in any moment in terms of how I am with other people, right? If someone has just hit me in the face in the moment, my range is pretty low, okay? But in this range, what do? You know? On the other hand, if someone is, like you were a little while ago, been very nice to me and complimentary, you know, my range maybe is up here. But again, here too, where am I in this range? And to me, that's kind of the question. What do in that range of what's actually authentically available? Sometimes the most that's authentically available for me in a moment is noble silence. I don't say anything at all. I don't put the person down. I wish them well. You know, I think about them as a child. I think about their love for other children. That's a way into it for me, and that's the best I can do. That's at the top of my range, you know. Other times, though, there's much more that's available to us. So I would ask a person, first of all, you know, where are you in your own range? And where we are in that range is a matter of will and intention. And it's okay that we choose intentionally to go to the top of our range. It doesn't make it phony. If we went outside our range, it would be false. But to deliberately intend to be kind or caring or patient or restrained inside our range of what's authentically possible, I think of that as doubly loving in a way, because we're both being kind to the other person and we intend to be kind to that other person. That's what I've found for myself. I don't think of this as having a rule around it. It's more like, where are you in terms of what's actually available to you? And it's okay if something even better is not available to you. You literally are just doing the best that you can. And then the last thing I'll just say is that I had a teacher make the point, Joseph Goldstein, that the essence of loving kindness, at least in the Buddhist frame, is the intention. We may not feel it, but we sincerely intend the other person to not suffer. We sincerely intend the other person to be happy, even if we're not feeling it very much. And often I've found that mobilizing the intention, and then even, you know, taking a little bit of action, gradually helps the feeling start to follow. Obviously, there's a art to that where we don't want to fake it till you make it kind of stuff, but there is a place for taking an action with a sincere heart and then seeing what happens afterward. So I better leave it at that. All right, it's late in the evening. I appreciate you sitting late with me. How about we just sit quietly for a moment and maybe let the Buddha's words and his own intentions echo inside you for another minute or so. I made just a last comment, which is that from the standpoint of brain science, as well as all kinds of other studies, there is so much evidence that people can really cultivate a loving heart, a compassionate heart, a patient heart, a caring heart. And it's good to have faith that your practices, your efforts will gradually change you for the better in some sense from the inside out. Or, if you will gradually reveal the profoundly loving heart that was always already there. Yeah. Be of good faith, be of good cheer, be of good heart. So, I'll see you in a few weeks, okay? Take care. Thanks.